Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, who's fact-checking the onslaught of wellness apps on the market?
And finding safe places for animals to cross busy roads.
But first, the group pushing a ballot measure to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution is suing over the description approved by a panel of lawmakers that voters would see in the official publicity pamphlet. Arizona for Abortion Access calls the language politicized, but it's not the only proposed description that has come under scrutiny. KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke from the Politics Desk is here now to talk more about this. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So let's start with who these lawmakers are and what exactly they're tasked with doing here.
So it's a committee essentially made up of Republicans and Democrats, and they have to agree on the language that's going to go out in these informational packets that Arizona voters are pretty familiar with, the big booklet that you get before the election that kind of explains what you're voting on. The language is initially crafted by nonpartisan legal staff, but then it has to go before this committee to get kind of tweaked and get the final approval from these lawmakers.
And is it typical that that panel of lawmakers will make some tweaks, make some adjustments?
Yeah, because as I said, the initial crafting is nonpartisan, and the language is supposed to remain neutral under Arizona law, but they, you know, do try and get little changes here and there that might tweak voter opinion one way or the other.
All right, so let's talk about some of those changes that were made on the proposed abortion initiative, which is now prompting a lawsuit. What is the controversy? What's the debate here?
So it's a debate over language. It's Democrats wanted the word to be essentially describing what would happen in an abortion. They wanted the word fetus to be used, and Republicans wanted the term unborn human being. And Republicans have more votes on the committee because they control the legislature, so they want out. So Democrats argued essentially that you're violating that tenet that it has to be neutral language, saying unborn human being is politically tinged, and that they believe fetus is kind of a more medically sound and neutral term there. Republicans, they've denied the allegation that they just think it's more accurate to say unborn human being, and that's led the abortion initiative to go to court to try and get a judge to side with them on this.
Is this the kind of thing that has been litigated in the past?
I'm not familiar with any legal precedent on this, but you know, anytime a politically charged topic like this is left in the hands of legislators, and there's a law that could potentially conflict, you typically see that type of thing go to court and let a judge interpret the law, and then you see it appealed, and we could see something like this go all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Sure. So as I mentioned, the abortion measure was not the only one that came under some scrutiny when this committee met. The proposed border security measure also, there was some let's call it discussion about that.
Yeah, there's the term illegal alien was used, which, a lot of Democrats, progressive groups, Latino rights groups think it is another politically tinged term. They think it's dehumanizing to immigrants, migrants, people coming across the border. But Republicans, just argue, this is a factually correct term. I think they pulled out a dictionary at one point and read what it meant. And then there's also disagreements over what language was chosen not to be included in that description and others in terms of what the financial ramifications on the state were. Under state law, they're supposed to include what those financial ramifications are, but they didn't. And Democrats said, we should be telling voters how much this is going to cost the state to implement.
Lastly, Wayne, we also saw some discussion about a measure that the legislature referred dealing with workers, tipped workers, essentially, right? Democrats were concerned that the language and maybe even the name of this measure was misleading, maybe?
Yeah, because it's I don't remember the exact title, but something about Protection Act for tipped workers. And they're basically saying this would actually allow employers to pay tipped workers less. And so they wanted to be explicitly clear about that. Again, another change that Republicans were against, because what it essentially would do is it would allow employers of tipped workers to pay them a less hourly wage if they're tipped tips bring them up to the minimum wage. So they're arguing that it's just an attempt to kind of counteract a citizen initiative that could be on the ballot that would raise the minimum wage by kind of confusing voters, giving them the thought that there's two competing proposals to protect worker wages when they say this is going to do the opposite.
Well, Wayne, speaking of that other measure, was that a contentious one, the description? I mean, did the Democrats and Republicans on this committee spar over the language on that one?
Less sparring over that one. I think it was more this one, because I think the attempt to confuse it, there's been a lot of allegations of the potential for different ballot initiatives to be thrown on there by the legislature to counteract these citizen initiatives. There was talk of an abortion one at one point. That didn't come to fruition. But again, we did see this tipped wage one come to fruition as there was talk of a citizen initiative going on the ballot to raise the minimum wage.
So as with any election related issue, I would imagine time is of the essence, right? I mean, these pamphlets have to get printed up at some point. Do we have a sense of what the deadline is for any legal wrangling to be completed?
So not in this case specifically because it's so new, but I actually was watching a separate case related to that border ballot initiative that you're talking about that is also challenging its ability to go on the ballot, which would affect ballot printing and all the things you're talking about. And in that case, the attorneys from both sides basically said they'd like the judge at the lower court level to get them a decision by the end of this month. That would then give either side the opportunity to appeal and hopefully get it wrapped up before the printing deadline, which is, I believe, at the end of August.
All right. That is Wayne Schutzke from KJZZ's Politics Desk. Wayne, thank you as always.
Yeah, thank you.
There are a lot of healthcare apps you can use on your phone that are FDA approved, things like diabetes monitors or radiology diagnosis tools. And then there are a lot of other apps that are healthcare adjacent. Think wellness apps that help you meditate, weight loss apps, or journaling apps. Those are not regulated, and that can be a problem, according to our next guest. Dr. Vail Wright is Senior Director of the Office of Healthcare Innovation for the American Psychological Association. I spoke with her more about the world of wellness and healthcare apps and how we can navigate them safely.
Health wellness apps, also referred to as direct-to-consumer apps, they're not intended to actually treat a mental health condition. So they're not there to help cure your depression or your anxiety. They're really meant to help aid in daily living by teaching coping skills and general well-being. Prescription digital interventions, however, are evidence-based, clinically validated interventions that are meant to treat mental health conditions like anxiety and depression.
Right. So the difference between like a talk therapy app where you're actually, you know, talking to a therapist just on your phone and something like an app that helps you meditate, right? There's a difference there.
There's a definite difference there. The apps that connect you with a provider where you do traditional talk therapy, we know that that type of intervention is very effective. The challenge with some of these wellness or consumer apps is that there's nobody really making any determination whether what they say they're doing is actually what they're doing.
Mm. So I wonder, in the world of apps, right, like you look at that marketplace, if you searched for healthcare or mental health or something like that in the app store, you would get a ton of different kinds of things. Do you think that consumers know the difference?
I'm not sure anybody can really tell the difference when you're talking about thousands of apps on an app store all saying something that sounds really great. Providers can't tell the difference. Consumers can't tell the difference.
Give us some examples of some of these kind of apps that are not necessarily treatment. What are the biggest ones out there? I think of Calm. Is Noom one of these?
Yeah. So Calm or Headspace, their primary mode of app delivery is using mindfulness and meditation. There's some good data that mindfulness and meditation helps with emotion regulation. But do their apps do what they say? It's sort of unclear. You have to check the data. Noom is another one that claims to use some psychological principles to help with weight loss. Some other kind of popular apps out there include chatbots like Wobot, which offer kind of coaching services, again, coping skills and other types of general lifestyle changes that you can make. On principle, they all sound great. It's just really hard to know if what they're actually delivering is effective.
Okay, so give us some advice as consumers. If you're looking for something like this, and you want something that might be effective, but it's not going to be FDA approved, how do you go about finding out which app might be useful and which might be complete bogus?
Unfortunately, you can't just rely on the App Store and the number of stars that an app might have. You have to dig deeper. And in fact, you really need to go to the website of that app. Look to see if they've published any independent research showing that they're effective. Look to see who their founders are and if they're employing subject matter experts or therapists that actually know the literature and the research as part of their developmental staff. Those are really key components to ensuring that at least this app may have something to offer.
So when we're talking about unregulated space in healthcare, it kind of reminds me of the conversation around things like supplements, right? Like, it's not like it's all bad. It's just that it's hard to tell what's good.
Very similar. Yeah. It's the space that, you know, where you have really probably some individuals with great intentions wanting to address the mental health crisis, putting the tools and the skills in the hands of people, but without anybody really checking to ensure that what they say is accurate, as a consumer, it can just be really hard to figure it out.
The other issue that comes up here a lot is privacy, right? Like when we're talking about healthcare information and giving it to, you know, an unregulated company.
Absolutely. These apps, not only are they not regulated by any sort of governmental entity, they actually are not subject to HIPAA. So there aren't any privacy laws about your personal healthcare information that's being protected. And that's huge because there could be lots of things that you're entering into these apps that's personally identifiable or healthcare information that you might not want out into the world.
Have you seen privacy violations? Are these sort of inevitable?
We have seen privacy violations with certain companies selling your personal data to, say, social media advertisers or other types of breaches of data. So it's just important for consumers to be aware of what they're putting into the app. Where is that data going? How is it stored? How is it being sold? And then you have to make a decision about what is comfortable for you.
So I wonder if you think there should be more regulation over this kind of thing. Like, is it crossing some kind of line in your mind because they do sort of purport to be healthcare based?
I think regulation in this space is critical. And you see it in some other countries, like in Europe, for example, they do have regulation in some of the space. I think it's really challenging when you start to peel back the onion, if you will, of all the things it would take to really regulate the space. And it's almost like the train has already left the station. I just don't know that there's any way to claw it back in a meaningful way. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try.
What kind of regulations exist in other countries? How effective are they?
Well, I think in other countries, like you have Orca, that is an evaluate tool that really does look at these different apps, creates evaluations, determines whether things are doing exactly what they say they are, whether they're valid, whether they're safe. I think it is effective often for, you know, these other countries. But again, we just don't have anything like that in place currently.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there. That is Dr. Vale Wright, Senior Director of the Office of Healthcare Innovation for the American Psychological Association. Thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to explain this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, an environmental journalist on the relationship between roads and wildlife.
But first, a recently published study finds members of Gen X are projected to have more instances of cancer than the previous generation, the baby boomers. Among women, data show there were higher rates of thyroid, kidney, colon, and pancreatic cancer, among others, in Gen Xers than in baby boomers. Gen X men had higher rates of thyroid, kidney, colon, and prostate cancers, among others, than baby boomers. With me to help explain what's going on and what it could mean is Dr. Madhapa Kundranda, a GI medical oncologist at Banner MD Anderson and chief for the Division of Hematology and Oncology. And Dr. Kundranda, what do you make of this data?
This study is certainly one of those studies that's comparing what we've traditionally thought about as the baby boomer generation, wherein the incidence of cancers in that generation, we've noticed over the last few decades of that generation increasing. This study actually looked at kind of the next step of that process, which is, okay, let's move on beyond the baby boomers and look at the Gen X. So this was an important study because we knew that yes, with baby boomers aging and the aging population increasing in the US, we were seeing an increased incidence there. But now that we have some of the baby boomers now in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, what's the next generation looking at?
Do you think there actually is more cancer within Gen X, or are we just better at detecting it and noticing that it's there than we have been in years past?
The technology has evolved, and if anything, in cancer detection, whether it's early diagnosis and thereby an increase in the incidence of cancers, we are starting to see that because, yes, whether it's a DNA testing for colon cancer, whether our mammographies have gotten much better, whether our screening technology, access to healthcare for the general population has gotten better, yes, it has. But the biggest thing is there's something called stage shifting, right? So what that simply means is if you can diagnose a cancer at a much earlier stage, then you can cure the patients as opposed to diagnosing it at a later stage and then not being able to do anything significant to make sure that that individual lives the rest of his or her life for the completion of their life. Detecting these cancers early doesn't necessarily mean we're stage shifting, meaning to say we're not really detecting stage one cancer significantly earlier. It is a little bit more of a complex question because in certain cancers we are making a difference, in others we aren't.
Well, it sounds like, at least in some cases, while there might be more instances of cancer in Gen X than baby boomers and previous generations, you're also able to catch it sooner, so the outcomes maybe are better than they would have been in years past.
Correct. So exactly. So you are spot on with regards to certain cancers wherein we're making a difference with regards to the stage shifting. In others, we're still not.
Is there anything interesting to you about the types of cancers that seem to be more prevalent in Gen X men or women than in previous generations?
Yes, that certainly seems to be the case. And not just based on this study, but even everything that we are looking at. For example, early onset GI cancers, some of those cancers, such as pancreatic cancer, such as colorectal cancer, have been increasing within this Gen X patient population. Some other cancers, breast cancer was the poster child for us with mammographies, with early detection, trying to really change the field, and we have changed the field to a certain extent. However, with breast cancer, we're starting to see an increased incidence within the Gen X as well. So it begs the question, what is going on there? And what really changed between that generation that was born between the late 60s to the late 70s?
Well, I mean, what do you think? Because, for example, like you think about something like lung cancer, and in the 60s and even in the 70s, smoking was so much more prevalent than it is now. Are there certain environmental factors that might be leading to some of these cancers? Is it just kind of a luck of the draw? Is there something else going on?
I wish I could say it was the luck of the draw. Unfortunately, it's not. And also, I can't tell you definitely that there's one or two factors making a difference, but the one thing that seems to be evolving, and especially over the last half decade or so, is this whole concept of exposome. So the pure definition of exposome is a measure of all of those exposures that any individual would have in their lifetime and how those exposures relate to their health. Now, this exposure could be external, right? And that's what you mentioned, tobacco, products, right? Physical activity, our diet, all of those. Or they could just be general external environmental exposure, which none of us really have a whole lot of control over, which is again the climate. It could be urban environment, it could be traffic, it could be the social capital aspect of it. And the part of it which is interesting is whether it's external environments that we have some control over, which are specific, or general external environments that we have limited to no control over. They tend to contribute to this whole thing of the internal environment as it pertains to, and without being very thing, again, when we look at proteomics or metabolomics or transcriptomics, and that can eventually affect the health and the overall incidence of cancer in a large patient population.
Well, so given, as you say, that there are some factors at play here, you know, that we don't have a whole lot of control over, would that lead you to believe that future generations might see even higher incidences of cancer than Gen X?
That is speculation, but I certainly would suspect that there would be certain cancers that we would continue to see an increased incidence. And that is exactly what we are seeing at this point in time, because we said, okay, tobacco can cause lung cancer. And we've seen generations, especially with males, with the decrease in the use of tobacco products and the decrease in tobacco-induced lung cancer. But then we've also seen the opposite of that, wherein with breast cancer, early detection was a huge part of this in the 70s and 80s. We've got better in terms of early detection as it pertains to mammographies and some of these other early techniques, but now we're starting to see that increase in this current generation. So the question becomes whether, as a society, as we continue to evolve and change, whether a lot of these factors are going to evolve. Unfortunately, it is. We would recognize certain high-risk factors that we would curtail and curb, but then there would be other factors that we continue to see that might cause an increase in some of these other cancers.
Dr. Madhapa Kundranda is a GI medical oncologist and chief for the Division of Hematology and Oncology at Banner MD Anderson.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. When Charles Jensen was a kid, he remembers going into the TV room to tell his mom he was depressed. As he sat next to her on the couch trying to explain how sad he'd been feeling, his mom kept one eye on the television, which meant their conversation was periodically interrupted by bursts of laughter from the studio audience of the sitcom she was watching. It's just one of many ways Jensen's realized that stories told on screen have helped him understand his life and relationships. And in his new memoir, Splice of Life, Jensen weaves together the most harrowing and bizarre experiences of his youth and young adulthood with scenes from films like Get Him to the Greek, Neon Demon, Mean Girls, and many others. As Jensen recently told the show's Sam Dingman, the book celebrates the weirdly specific connections we all feel to our favorite movies.
I think people are doing the things that I do in Splice of Life all the time, and maybe not consciously or purposefully, but I think the movies that we love are all movies that resonate with us because they help us understand ourselves better or they help us understand our experiences better.
Yeah. Well, can we talk about your chapter on the movie The Descent? Tell us about the period of your life that you decided to write about that felt connected to that film.
When I was in my late 20s, the first boyfriend that I was in a long-term relationship with had taken his own life, and it was very shocking to me. We had been broken up for several years, but we were still connected in a bunch of different ways, and we had just been in contact a couple months before this happened. So when I, in the chapter, I recount, you know, the moment that I got the news that this had happened and working through what was an overwhelming and unexpected kind of grief I had never experienced before and felt like I couldn't even find my way out of. So it felt very natural to me to pair that with this movie, The Descent, which is a horror film from the early 2000s about a group of women who go spelunking and get trapped in a cave only to discover that they're not alone. And the other presences in the cave are pursuing them to kill them. The resonance for me is that grief was like being trapped in those caves. And it just seemed like no matter what direction I went in, I was still stuck in there. The main character of that movie, herself is recovering from the grief of losing her husband and daughter in a car accident the year before. So I did feel in some ways that the film was trying to say that grief is impossible to find your way out of.
Yeah, my favorite line from that chapter is you write, "The mind's relationship to grief is like the tongue's insistence on exploring the place where a tooth's been lost." I have seen The Descent before. It's the most scared I've ever been.
It is a really good horror movie.
And it had not occurred to me that it could operate so thoroughly and completely on this metaphorical level that you've laid out. And it made me want to go back and watch it again and, mm-hmm. and think about it through that lens, because all of a sudden it started to feel like a, you know, very graphic and visceral, but very lyrical grief poem rather than a story about claustrophobia and maybe zombies, question mark.
Yeah, right. But isn't that what grief is? And, you know, grief is the experience of being haunted in some ways. Mm-hmm. And also you're not in control of your thoughts. Like, your mind will really just race through a variety of emotions or memories. There is something horrific about grief that I think resonates.
Can I ask you in that vein about the cat scene?
Oh, yeah. In the chapter about the suicide?
Yeah, because I got like an actual chill reading that section. Mm-hmm. Can you describe briefly for us the cat scene?
Sure. So my boyfriend Tori had been, you know, a lover of cats, and he even had a cat tattoo. So in the days after he had, maybe weeks after he had died, I started to hear a cat meowing in my house, and I looked everywhere and I couldn't find it. And it really took me, I think, a full day to track it down, what the noise was coming from. I don't even know why I did this, but I went out to the carport, I looked all over, and then I just opened the hood of my car and a kitten was sitting on the engine. And I just had a recognition in that moment that this was perhaps a way that I was being visited by, you know, Tori's spirit or his consciousness or something, but just a way to like heal me a little bit in a way that I wasn't able to do on my own. And when I reached to grab the cat, it, you know, jumped down through the engine and ran off.
Well, and not to edit your own memory of your story, but the car that the cat was in was the car you and Tori had gotten together, right?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's just amazing. And one of the reasons it gave me such a chill is because it comes, I don't know if it's right after, I can't remember, but in close relationship to the part at the very end of The Descent when we think the main character has escaped the subterranean caverns, mm-hmm. and she gets in her car and starts driving away from this trauma, and then one of her antagonizers appears in the backseat of the car.
Right. And it's in the movie, it's deeply uncertain if that's happening or not, right? If that's reality.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which made me think about your sense of disbelief that the cat was there, and then the fact that the cat disappears and
yeah.
prompts you to ask, like, was that cat really there? Like, did that just mm-hmm. happen?
Yeah. And weirdly, that happened to me twice when I lived in Phoenix.
Really?
A cat crawled into my engine. The second time I did rescue the cat and gave it a good home. But that first one, did run away.
What are these cats doing? I think it's hotter in there.
I know.
We meet a lot of interesting characters in the stories from your life, but for me, Tori really is the one who stands out. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that Tori's experiences are often almost like more extreme versions of things that you experience personally. Suicidal ideation, shame about sexuality, status anxiety. And it almost felt like Tori's life is kind of like the movie version of your life in this sort of warped way. How much of your desire to write this book was motivated by your relationship to and memories of Tori specifically?
Well, that's a very – I'm going to sit with that for a long time now that you've said that.
Oh, no.
Me.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all good. Tori's death had such a huge impact on me as a person, and how I engaged in romantic relationships after that, how I grieved loss, that you're right. It is such a core aspect of the book. And so you know, he was a complicated person. We had a complicated relationship. So there are still things that I'm learning from about that experience. But I think what I discovered in the course of writing a memoir is that the book is not about other people. The book is really about me and holding myself accountable for my lived experience. But it also yielded all sorts of empathy for the other people in my life, especially the people that I had complicated relationships with. For me, you know, that was the real value in just feeling a lot more settled about some of these experiences I've lived.
For what it's worth, for me, you just described the thing that movies can do better than anything else. I mean, it's why we love anti-hero stories so much, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I know some people don't, but it's why I should say a lot of people love anti-hero stories is because it does. It puts you in this surprising position of empathizing with somebody who behaves terribly.
Yes. But
we get a sense of where that comes from and what the through line between those behaviors is.
I think it's a reminder, too, that we are the villain in someone's story, whether we intend to be or not. And it's a reminder that the villains in our story may not intend to be that for us either.
Charles Jensen, author of Splice of Life, a memoir in 13 film genres. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Major League Baseball is approaching its annual All-Star Game, with the Midsummer Classic representing a proverbial midway point of the season. At this point, the Diamondbacks have lost more games than they have won, but there are still 70 games to go in the regular season, which also means the organization will be hosting plenty more themed game nights, from Women's Night to Hispanic Heritage Night to Faith and Family Night, which happens next month. But what began as an historically multi-faith night in many baseball organizations has become specifically associated with evangelical Christianity, according to our next guest. Paul Putz is assistant director of the Faith and Sports Institute at Baylor's Truett Seminary, and I spoke with him earlier this year about these faith-themed nights at the ballpark and how they've become increasingly politicized.
You can really go back to the beginning of professional baseball in a certain sense, not necessarily with the faith-based themes associated with ticket sales, but with the desire to cultivate a church-going audience. So back when professional baseball is beginning, there were a lot of Americans, middle class, white, quote-unquote respectable, going to church, who didn't like some of the gambling and drinking and Sabbath breaking, playing on Sunday, associated with pro baseball. And so some baseball leagues would try to market to that audience, and they would try to let them know that we're limiting some of these things you don't like, the alcohol, the gambling, those parts of it. So from the very beginning, there was a sense of audience, that there is this church-going audience who baseball leagues and teams should be aware of and should maybe try to engage with.
And toward the beginning, they were sort of multi-faith, it sounds like. Is that right?
Yeah. So when you begin to see the organized faith nights, that really emerges in the 1950s. And the earliest ones that I found examples of were interfaith nights. This is at a time when America has just gotten out of World War II. The Cold War is starting. There is a sense of the atomic bomb has just been dropped. There's a sense of existential dread and crisis. And who are we as a country? There's the Soviet Union, which is communist, and communism is associated with atheism. And so there's this sort of broad general belief in faith that for a lot of Americans is defining what it means to be an American. I mean, this is the era in the 1950s when "under God" is put into the Pledge of Allegiance. And so in the same way, sporting events becomes an opportunity to try to promote an image of faith, but an image of faith that's tied with pluralism, a sense of cooperation and belonging. And so the Baltimore Orioles in the 1940s and 1950s, they host these interfaith nights where they have Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish fans, and they're trying to promote an image of tri-faith America to fit into some of these Cold War trends.
That's really interesting. But it seems to have shifted in recent history, right? Like this is a term now, faith and faith night, or family and faith night, as it may be called in some organizations, are pretty linked to Christianity nowadays, right?
Yeah, and I would say even a particular type of Christianity, an evangelical version of Christianity. Mm. And frankly, I have to include my own organization in this. We call ourselves the Faith and Sports Institute. And although we are interested in all areas where faith might intersect with sports, we are at an evangelical seminary. And so for us, the word faith is tied into sort of a default mode of evangelical expressions of faith. And I think many times that word has been coded in terms of sort of American cultural consumption as something linked with a conservative Christian approach. And we see that with the Faith Knights as well in Major League Baseball or in other sports. Usually, if there's just a broadly named Faith Knight, it is going to be some sort of evangelical faith night.
Interesting. Okay, so that has changed quite a bit then. And recently, it seems like there's been a bit of a push and pull around this. Like, it's become politicized in a way. What happened last year in L.A. at the Dodgers Stadium was an interesting example of this, right? Like, there were protests over this certain group being involved in the Pride Night there, which is kind of on the other end of the spectrum. And then the pitcher, Clayton Kershaw, sort of asked the organization to expedite the announcement of this relaunch of a specifically Christian faith and family night. Are we seeing sort of faith themed nights coming in response to Pride nights? Is that what's happening?
I think the order is probably a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So in 1991, or when we first saw some of these Christian faith and family days that were organized, and it started with the St. Louis Cardinals. They host the first event, and it is linked with this conservative evangelical understanding of the faith, but also with some conservative politics are sort of by default associated with these faith and family days early on. After 1991, when we get to 2005, we have another version of these events, which are launched and led by a promoter named Brent High. And he goes to the Atlanta Braves. And in 2006, he's able to get the Atlanta Braves to host one of these faith and family events. So we actually see the faith and family nights associated with a broadly conservative evangelical version of the faith. Those are happening in the 90s and early 2000s. The Pride nights and the popularity for Pride nights really comes after that. And we do see more of them. So last year, I think 29 of 30 Major League Baseball teams hosted a Pride night.
Right.
And only 18 of 30 hosted a faith night. So it's true that we do see more Pride nights in Major League Baseball, but those came after the faith and family events that were happening, you know, earlier on in the 1990s.
So what do you think this is? Like, do you think this is sports responding to the culture, trying to sort of appeal to everyone? Do you think that's a good thing?
I do. I think it's a good thing to have a faith and family night, and I think it's a good thing for teams to host a Pride night. I think at Major League Baseball stadiums, you know, we can mythologize and maybe go too far in talking about how sports promotes unity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the truth is sports always have been political. They always have been a place where Americans have competing ideas about what it means to belong, who we are as a country. All of those things play out in sports too. But it's also true that sports are one of those few spaces in our communities where you really do have a diversity of values and beliefs and opinions all shared by a fan base. And they have this one thing in common, is that they root for a particular team. And so I think if you're a team, a Major League Baseball team or any sports team, you would want to say, if you're a fan, you're welcome here. And for Major League Baseball, 162 games, there's just going to be a lot of promotions that you need to have. There's going to be Star Wars events and, you know, all sorts of other nights that you might have. So to have, you know, one day of the year where you reach out to a segment of your fan base, maybe, you know, one of those days it's the LGBTQ plus community, one of those days it's the conservative Christian community, I think that's actually a healthy thing for American society to be able to do that. So of course there are dangers and there's potential areas of conflict and controversy, but as a whole, I would like to see that practiced and even celebrated, that we can have fan bases that have diverse opinions, but they have this one thing in common.
Is it, though, contributing to division to sort of, you know, you have your night and you have yours and everybody sort of taking to their corners in a way?
That's a possibility. I think that certainly could happen. I also think it could be an opportunity to find ways to maybe connect and reach out. But you're absolutely right. It also is a chance to exacerbate tensions. I think people are always looking to find something to get mad about. Mm-hmm. And in our social media age, that is a real challenge, that, you know, what plays out in the stadium in a local community can become used to, you know, to generate outrage or to become part of this broader culture war narrative. So I recognize that danger. I still think that it can be a healthy thing for a team to recognize different types of fan bases that it has, and a healthy pluralism allows people to be public about who they are and what they value, but to do so in a way where they still belong. They're still a part of the community, a part of the fan base.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. That is Paul Putz, Assistant Director of the Faith and Sports Institute at Baylor's Truett Seminary. Paul, thank you for coming on. Thanks for talking about this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Arizona's two U.S. senators late last year announced the state would be getting around $24 million to build nearly 17 miles of wildlife fencing along I-17. The fences aim to prevent animal vehicle crashes. The money comes from the bipartisan infrastructure law approved by Congress and signed by President Biden in 2021. That measure includes the Wildlife Crossing Program, which sets aside $350 million nationwide for projects to prevent these kinds of collisions. The issue is one Ben Goldfarb has thought about a lot. He's an environmental journalist and author of the book Crossings: How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. He joins me to talk more about this. And Ben, what got you thinking about the ways roads impact not just people getting from, say, point A to point B, but have maybe a bigger impact on ecology and the environment?
Yeah, you know, as an environmental journalist, I often find myself covering the concept of habitat connectivity, basically the idea that animals need to move across large landscapes to find all the things they need. They need food and they need shelter and they need mates, right? And often, you know, our infrastructure in towns and farms and so on gets in the way of that. So, you know, about a decade ago in the fall of 2013, I was in Montana writing about this idea of sort of habitats and linking landscapes so that animals like elk and moose and bears can kind of wander unhindered. And, you know, Highway 93 in Montana was kind of getting in the way of that. And I had an opportunity to go onto this wildlife overpass that had been built to allow animals to safely cross this highway. And it was just so inspiring to be on top of this, you know, this beautiful, graceful bridge crossing the highway. You know, we do so much on this planet to make animals' lives harder and more dangerous. And here was, you know, this infrastructure we'd spent millions of dollars on to make their lives a little bit easier and safer. And, you know, I just found that to be kind of an inspiring and beautiful idea. And it got me thinking more about how roads impact nature and what we can do to kind of manage those impacts.
How prevalent have those kinds of crossings become in terms of overpasses, underpasses, bridges, tunnels, things like that for wildlife specifically?
Yeah, they've become much more prevalent, and they're still not prevalent enough, I think, is, you know, sort of the two-part answer. I mean, at this point, you know, there are probably a couple thousand of them around the country, and everything from overpasses for antelope in Wyoming to, you know, little culverts for frogs and salamanders in Vermont. So they're certainly out there. You know, Arizona is actually sort of a kind of a great case study in how effective they can be. There are a number of underpasses with fences alongside them for elk on Highway 260 in Arizona, and those, you know, those structures have been really effective. They've reduced crashes by, or at least elk collisions by, you know, around 90%, and they've paid for their own construction costs by preventing these dangerous, expensive, large animal crashes. So, you know, certainly that's a great example of how well they can work. But at the same time, you know, we need many more of them because there are lots of animal collision hotspots that are not addressed.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned that, you know, these can cost millions of dollars. And, you know, it seems as though when a project like this is proposed, at least there's some segment of the population that will kind of mock it, saying like, hey, why are we spending so much money so elk can cross a highway, or so, you know, frogs and toads have a place to cross the road? Do you find that in places where this maybe isn't happening as quickly as it could, is that kind of an impediment to making it happen?
Yeah, it's definitely an impediment. I mean, it's certainly an impediment for those smaller animals now, right? I mean, at this point, you know, again, as I said, the great thing about these wildlife crossings is that they do often pay for themselves when they're built to help large animals cross the highway, right? I mean, the average deer collision now costs society more than $9,000 in vehicle repairs and hospital bills and tow truck expenses and so on. You know, the average elk collision is more than $20,000. The average moose collision is more than $40,000, right? So these are really, again, dangerous, expensive events. And, you know, by building fences and crossings that prevent them, you know, we can really save the public a lot of money. You know, the problem is when it comes to those smaller animals, right? Nobody's ever, you know, totaled their car running over a, you know, a rattlesnake or a, you know, a frog or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, those can be harder to justify from, you know, kind of a direct cost benefit standpoint. And, you know, those are the projects that don't get built enough probably and, you know, get mocked when they do get built, as you said.
Are there other benefits for the animals or maybe for the environment in general of these kinds of projects other than giving animals a safe passage across the road and maybe reducing, as you say, collisions between vehicles and these animals?
Yeah, you know, I think one really important thing to remember is that the collision itself is just part of the way in which the highway is affecting the animal, right? You know, animals, as I said earlier, need to move across these big landscapes to find everything they need. You know, and that's especially true in Colorado where I live and, you know, other states like Wyoming. And it's, you know, it's true in Arizona as well. You know, and there are some really tragic instances of, you know, big interstate highways that have basically prevented herds of mule deer and elk and pronghorn and other animals from, you know, migrating across these large landscapes. And, you know, in Wyoming, for example, we've seen herds of mule deer actually starve kind of en masse, not because the cars hit them, right, but because the kind of the constant traffic of a big interstate prevented them from getting to these, you know, low elevation winter ranges that they need to reach, you know, during the snowy months to survive. So, you know, in some ways that's almost worse than the roadkill itself, right? You know, a herd of mule deer can survive a few collisions. What they can't survive is losing access to all of that habitat. So that kind of moving fence effect of traffic is a really huge problem.
Right. When you talk about animal crossings over roads and highways, is it possible to build them so that multiple species are able to use them? I mean, you talked about, for example, a bridge in Arizona for elk. I mean, is it possible that other animals could use that as well? Or do different kinds of animals need different kinds of crossings?
Yeah, you know, I mean, certainly it's possible to design crossings that, you know, that benefit multiple species. And, you know, those underpasses for elk in Arizona have been used not only by elk, but by, you know, by deer and mountain lions and bobcats and all kinds of critters, you know. And but you're right that each species sort of requires different, you know, habitat features to, you know, make it appealing to them.
It's interesting that you bring that up because, like, in thinking about this, you know, I can imagine designers designing these crossings and engineers and builders building them. But then the question is, how do you get the animals to use them? Like, you obviously can't put up a sign for the animal, say, hey, this is a safe place to cross the road so you don't get hit. So it sounds like what you're saying is, like, in the designers and the engineers have to make it really appealing to the animals to sort of check it out. And then they kind of figure it out from there.
Yeah, I mean, the crossings themselves definitely have to be appealing. But, you know, part of that is also the fences that run along the crossings, right? You know, the animal is trying to cross the road, it hits the fence, it kind of walks along the fence line looking for a place. And, you know, all of a sudden, it bumps into that, you know, that good looking crossing. So when they built those elk underpasses on State Highway 260 in Arizona, you know, at first, they just built the underpasses without any fences. And that actually didn't help. You know, wildlife collisions did not go down until they added the fences to guide the animals to the crossing. So the fences are a really important part of it. But the other cool thing that happens over time, too, is that, you know, as the animals cross at those crossings repeatedly, you know, they actually create little game trails, you know, little animal footpaths. And, you know, animals follow animal trails. And so it's like all of the animals together are sort of learning collectively how to use these things.
All right. That is Ben Goldfarb, an environmental journalist, author of the new book, Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Ben, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me.
right, that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you heard a song you liked on today's show, you can now follow us on Spotify. Just search KJZZ's The Show on the app, and you can find all the music we played in June. That'll do it for us today. Thanks for joining us. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.